What about the Stanley Cup stuff? Were you at that party?
Yes, I was there. That fucker went right off the balcony into the pool.
And apparently I threw something at Eddie Van Halen's head. I don't remember that.
Man, Dime always had fireworks backstage. I don't know how many times we had the fire marshal back in the dressing room going, "Guys, you can't be doing this." And then, they'd, "Hey, oh, come on, man, do a shot with us." And sure enough, they'd get the fire marshal drunk. And so us and Cheap Trick go down to this little bitty basement bar in Tokyo, Japan, and we're just partying, having a blast. And me and Dime are just standing at the bottom of the stairs. And here comes Rick Nielsen in this really, really loud red suit, something you would totally see Rick Nielsen wearing. And he comes right down to the bottom of the stairs, and it's just me and Dime standing there. And he goes, "Well, boys, are we ready to party?" And he fans out this huge fan of money and just goes, "Ha ha 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 ha," just does this weird laugh.
I fucking hate Weezer. Those fucking dudes can suck my dick.
Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rody, it's now available through Amazon and paperback Kindle or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show. Jeffrey Pierce has worked as a guitar tech for Lillian Axe, Stripmind, Musa Chunka, and Evermore. He's now a freelance promoter rep for Live Nation and Outback Presents. Sterling Winfield is a producer, engineer, bass tech, and guitar tech. He's worked for Pantera, Hell Yeah, Texas Hippie Coalition, Erykah Badu, Ghostface Killah, Hatebreed, Damage Plan, Nickelback, Night Ranger, and even B.B. King. Welcome, fellas. So my first question, yo, first question, how do you guys know each other?
How do we know each other?
Do you even know each other? Do you even like each other? Are you friends?
We met so long ago, and it was probably at, what, the clubhouse or something? Or even before that?
Was he the guy trying to put change in the girl's underwear?
Yeah. I don't remember that part.
Guy getting kicked out?
I also worked for some of the Pantera who do these little side bands called Gasoline. And then I worked for a guy with this one band called Hillbilly Orchestra, which was on Vinnie Paul's label. So we were just always in the same circles.
Yeah.
Okay.
Living in the same, both living in Dallas.
Yeah, 15, 17 years, something like that.
Oh,
yeah. Even longer than that, probably 20 years.
Well, we got really close about 12 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, right on. So you said you're a teacher, Sterling. What are you teaching?
I teach advanced audio, like advanced mixing and advanced Pro Tools at a local school here, audio school called MediaTek Institute.
Just I thought you were going to say like biotech.
No, God, no. I'm not in that tax bracket. But
no, not yet.
Not yet. But yeah, advanced audio stuff over at one of the audio schools here in Dallas.
Cool. All right. I'm going to come out. I'm going to give you guys some shit. I might have talked to a guy named Marcus Rafferty today.
Uh-oh.
I might have chatted to this fella and show him a shout out. He's actually playing in Mudvayne right now. We're really excited for that fucking guy. But he told me, so here's the deal. He sent me a photo, or it's not a photo. It's like artwork of like a South Park looking guy. And it says, just bring this up and have him explain what it means. Mentioned 2010, the Stampede album at Vinny's house. And the little artwork said Chipotle Way, and the guy has like fucked up tighty whities or something. I'll try, if I know how to post it, I'll try and put it on there.
Okay.
Do you wear tight whities or something? Or is that...
Just us cutting up while we were making the Stampede album. Marcus was there teching for it was Greg and Tom at that point. And Tom Maxwell and Greg Tribbett. And we got on this South Park kick and just funniness ensued. You know, it was always either South Park or Team America that we had going on infinite repeat downstairs, you know, and just always laughing about it. And the whole Chipotle way episode where, you know, do you have Chipotle way? If you eat Chipotle, you're going to need it to clean the blood stains out of your underwear. And just, yeah, hilarious stuff. Just always fun. Always somebody laughing at something around there.
Yeah, good times. It's important. You know, I know one of the stories, you know, stick with Pantera for a few minutes, but the one with the, actually, I'll tell you one of mine. So I was at a show. I was working for Poison, and I couldn't believe it, but all the Pantera guys showed up to one of the Poison shows when we were in Talis. And I'm thinking, like, how the fuck would they come here? I didn't know it. And so after, we all went to the clubhouse after, but I was, I guess Pantera was a hair band. I know. So they were a hair band when they first started, and they had stayed in touch with the Poison guys. They were all buddies.
Mm.
But are you with them back then when they did like hair music and stuff?
No, I didn't get with them until October of 93. They came into Dallas Sound Lab, the studio where I was working, to finish Far Beyond Driven with Terry Date. And me and another house engineer there at Dallas Sound Lab got the gig of, you know, being their right-hand guys for Terry. Tim Kimsey was the second engineer on Far Beyond Driven on the mix and recording side of things. And I was the assistant. And that meant, you know, making coffee, going to get all the booze for the day, you know.
Whose truck did you use, Jeff's?
No, he wasn't around then.
Is he a big rig driver?
At the actual studio. But no, actually I used mine, or Dime would give me the keys to his. So, yeah, they'd give me the American Express card, and I'd go down the street about... Jeff, you remember where all the liquor stores were there on Northwest Highway where Dallas City Limits was, right? And that's where they'd send me every day, and they'd give me the credit card, and it'd be like $250, $300 worth of booze every day. You know, beer, whiskey, all the stuff you take back. And then I'd stock the refrigerator, and we'd start about 5:30 in the afternoon and go all night.
Were you guys a fan before working for the camp?
I was, for sure. I was listening to all that hair band stuff when I was in junior high and high school. I lived out in San Angelo, Texas, and I knew of them and was a fan of them before I even met them.
That's neat.
Yeah, it was like a dream come true, literally. So, yeah.
How about you, Jeff?
I was just thinking, I was just doing a show with a famous promoter named Danny Eaton, and when they were doing Pantera here in town at the State Fair Park Coliseum, and I was at the show, and there were more people backstage than there were in the audience. And walking crowd, and Tommy, who used to be the drummer of Lillian Axe, was the drummer Godsmack, and he pushed me, and Godsmack had shown up at the show, and Danny sent their runner down, and they literally bought out the entire store in South Dallas of the liquor store.
Wow.
Yeah. It was amazing. That one particular show he's talking about, they had put these boards down on over the ice because it was a hockey rink for other events. And they had been told, you better hire more security, or there's gonna be trouble. You're gonna have to hire more security. And
is it the little girls who go ice skating there and they want to get back into the venue?
I don't know, but they were just like, this is a Pantera show, you gotta hire more security. And they were like, nope, we've got everything we need, we've got this covered. And sure enough, they were pulling the boards up and setting them on fire, and people were crowd surfing on these big giant 4x8 sheets of plywood. It was just complete and total mayhem, because security basically gave up, and all the people from the bleachers came pouring over the walls into the actual arena floor, and they gave up. They stopped.
Well, and, I was there with Max, and we were like going out to the soundboard to say hi to Wires and Sonny, and we walked 10 feet out in that crowd and said, nope.
Yeah, it was nuts, man. And there's like, it was a Pantera hometown show, so there was always, you know, 12, 1500 people on the guest list, no joke. And so that's what Jeff means by that. The whole backstage was reserved for all the guests, and the bands had these little bitty dressing rooms, and then the guests had all the space back there, plus an open bar and everything else you can imagine. So they always threw down for their friends, for sure.
Sounds terrible.
It was awful.
And Sonny just sat there in front of house, just pushing buttons. It's like, just stay away. Funny.
Never saw. We were too afraid to go out there.
And then you said, so you knew Lee Gibson too? He was working at the same time? Or?
Yeah, he was around during, I want to say Far Beyond Driven, but I can't remember. I can't remember exactly when Lee was around. Forgive
Neither
me.
Neither can he.
It's been a long time since I've seen him. Yeah.
Yeah. So you were saying that the guy used to wear a jacket, right?
Dude, he used to just wear this jacket, this windbreaker jacket, no matter how hot it was outside. And me and Sonny would call him the vampire. Lee.
So this guy,
he went over at Paisley Park, and he was a super cool dude, man. Super cool.
Oh, different guy.
Not him, huh?
You know what's funny is the guy has like a full body tattoo of an alien, and yet the entire time he wears like long sleeves and shit hiding it. If you're gonna do that much work, wouldn't you like be like, check out my shit? So we were doing Guns N' Roses together in Rio, and it's hot. I mean, really, holy shit. And he got a bet given to him that he could not keep his sweater on, or his jumper, he'd say, because English fuck, his jumper on for the entire gig of like 2 days or whatever that we were at the venue. And he kept it on a long time, but he had to take it off, man. Yeah, he lost. He had to take it off.
Too hot for Lee.
But he had one of those like the like fuzzy looking things, you know? So we're talking like a lot of heat in there, man. And he was just all quiet. He was just all, cause he didn't want to lose the bet. So he just,
what was the bet? What was the pay? The pay?
Probably no pay. Probably just, you know, the right to tell you you're bragging right fuck or something.
I made Lee take off his jacket.
Made him to get naked. I don't know. What about the Stanley Cup stuff? Were you at that party?
Yes. I was there. That fucker went right off the balcony into the pool.
I shouldn't lie. I don't know. If I was a bigger hockey fan, maybe I wouldn't laugh so much. But how did it all come about? What was going on? I mean, just everybody's wasted drunk or?
Yeah, just having fun, man. Listen, it's party time and you're in Texas and we were just having a blast. We had several, however long the playoffs are, several weeks before. Vinny had been kicking around the idea with Craig Ludwig about writing a song for them, you know, like a fight song. And so we did it down in the studio one day. We were already in the middle of working on one of the projects, either Rebel Meets Rebel or Reinventing the Steel, one of those projects. And so it came about and they just said, hey, we're going to do this today. Dime, what do you got? Blah, blah, blah. So Dime and Vinny got together and I recorded this whole thing, and I think Grady's on there. Grady Champion is on there doing background vocals for where they're shouting Dallas Stars. And I'm in there shouting from the other room, but I was having to be the tape op.
Was it like Dallas Stars?
Yeah. Dallas. But, so yeah, I got to record that. And so we got it to them and it turned out to be their main thing that helped them get pumped up in the locker room before and during in between periods so when they won the cup, they of course brought it by Vinny's house and one of our bars that we used to hang out at, over in South Arlington or North Arlington. And we, you know, shit gets wild. You know, you drink a few dozen shots out of that thing and people go crazy. And hey, there's a giant pool down there and everything in the world's been done to that Stanley Cup, dude. Don't think it hasn't. Those
I saw the pictures with Jeff naked running around.
Thing. Dude, it's silly. Some dudes eat cereal out of it. Some dudes, you know, sleep with it. You know, they each get a day with it. So, you know, those guys that guard the thing, the guys that look like Secret Service guys, those guys should write a book.
For yeah. Sure.
So, yeah. And yeah, man, it went off the balcony and right into the pool.
So whose day was it when they went in, they brought it to the party?
I think it was before they started giving them individual days, because it was right after they won the cup. It was like literally within 24 hours of them getting home. It was like really fast after that, because we did that all happened the night before the parade that was in Dallas. So yeah, it was like within 24, 48 hours.
Who threw it?
I don't remember that part. I just remember hearing the commotion and going, what? And turning around and there it went.
So, and did it really get dented?
I don't remember it getting dented. I just remember it going off the balcony. Now, sources will tell you that if you look at the cup when they got off the airplane at the airport, it was already dented, and because Ed Belfour dropped it. So, but the mythos that keeps getting surrounding it is that, well, it did go off the balcony at Vinnie Paul's house, which is true, and it did get pushed to the bottom of the pool, which is true. So, you know, who's to say? I don't know.
What like for me, seeing the Pantera guys at a Poison show was cool, actually. You know, when you guys both, you do gig after gig after gig, it's nice to see things you don't expect. It kind of switches shit up a little bit.
Always.
Also, it didn't hurt. They were all actually pretty cool guys, you know.
Vinny and Brett ended up being pretty close.
Yeah. Brett's a great guy. He really is. He's a really nice dude. And what people, celebrities, does stand out to you, like seeing at a Pantera show where you're like, holy, wouldn't expect to see them be a fan? Or Vaseline, one of the offshoots, Jeff, whatever.
Joey Buttafuoco used to come out to the shows when we'd go through Nassau. Sometimes when we hit the Midwest, Screech from Saved by the Bell.
Oh, Dustin Diamond. Yeah, yeah.
He would come out to the shows. That kid that was the kid in The Sopranos would come out to the shows. You get these weird guests sometimes. I heard a knock on the dressing room door one time and I opened it and it was Brian May.
He's
like, hello.
You know, did he ask for a comb?
Surreal. You know, just, hey, hello, I just wanted to come in and say hello to the chaps and wish them good luck or whatever. And just he ended up coming in and just hanging out for like a couple of hours.
Oh, a long time.
Yeah. So.
Wow. Did he say what his favorite Pantera album was?
No, he said his kid turned him on to Pantera and that he would have had his kid with him, but he got some bad marks in school and had to stay. He got grounded and stayed home. And then his kid locked him out of his house. Of his own house. So we thought that was funny. So he was just hanging there with his wife at Donington and just was hanging with us. And, you know, it was such a surreal day that day. That was my first real big show with them in 94.
And you get to meet Brian May.
Brian May. And then we go outside and Joe Perry's outside and he's like, hey, man, he's waving at Dime. And it's just like so such a surreal day.
Yeah.
Strange day.
You know, a friend of mine, his name's Darren Paltrowitz. He has a podcast and he said that he had interviewed Rita, Daryl's widow. And he said that she told him a story that they had named their mattress Gene Simmons.
Mm-hmm.
Because Daryl loved to nickname shit.
Always. He had a name for everything, right, Jeff? He had his own language. We called it Dimebonics.
Why would you name your mattress Gene Simmons? Or there was no explanation to the nicknames.
It was a Simmons Beauty Rest. mattress. So
that actually makes sense.
I'm going to go get in the gene and get some downtime. You know, that's what he would say. I'm going to go get in the gene.
What are some of the other nicknames?
Oh, Jesus. I'm trying to remember. If you were to have to, if you were like, say, he would say, here, take, hold this paper or hold this pen or, you know, whatever you were doing, help me with this amplifier over here. He would say, Andrew, that like, take care of it, grab it, haul it with you. And that meant that's Andrew. So it was because they toured with Judas Priest and one of their band assistants' name was Andrew. Huh. So that was one of his names for, hey, take care of this or carry this, Andrew this.
You know, in its own way, it's kind of like job security, because if you know all the little isms, you're kind of like, can't get rid of that guy. He already knows.
Totally. We all knew how he spoke. and we go, okay. But yeah, that was one of them. Andrew. Shit. There were so many. like when we were recording guitars and there would be too much string noise. Fret noise, you know, like those string squeaks. Me and him actually coined the term Vernon after Vernon Reed.
Oh, hell yeah.
Vernon Reed has all that stuff. He leaves all that stuff in there. Yeah. And we would always be like, ooh, you better catch that Vernon right there and get that Vernon out of there. You know, stuff like that. Just little silly stuff.
I had Corey Glover on here and that guy he's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done a gig with him. He was out on,
he was in Platoon.
Yeah, he was.
That was nuts.
Awesome movie.
Yeah, super cool cat. Like, amazingly interesting.
He was super nice when I met him. He was doing a show at the Majestic. You remember that, Jeff? Me and Jeff used to work at the Majestic Theater here in Dallas.
Yeah, nice place.
It was. Were you on that show, the Bowie tribute thing that him and Charlie Sexton did?
I don't remember. I try to forget shows as soon as I do them.
That's what happens nowadays anyways. You know, me and him are still in the live sound industry. I do live sound.
I find crew shirts that I'm like, I guess I worked this show, I had no idea.
You sell them now.
Totally.
Speaking of Grady, was selling them
on eBay
stuff, dude. Grady got bank for a bunch of his Pantera.
Yeah, the old Pantera stuff. Yeah,
got really good money.
He got like $2,000 for that jumpsuit, that Pantera crew jumpsuit.
Oh shit!
They used to make us wear those on Trendkill.
You still have yours?
Nah.
I should say, I'll offer you $2,000 at $5. He'll be like,
2001, Grady.
No, I'm a big spender. What was your guys' first nationwide tour?
Nationwide for me was Lil Nas X during their True Believer tour. And it's my first international tour. And I was, I think, 19.
Oh, you're a kid. How did you get the gig? How did you get into music, Jeff?
I worked for every local band in Dallas. I mean, if you named a local band, I probably guitar tech for them. And I do not know how to play guitar to save my life, which is ironic. I just worked for every band and I picked up whatever I could. And finally, the guys from Lil Nas X were, they finally threw me a bone and said, come on out with us. It was quite an adventure.
Cool. And then from there, so now you've been working as a promoter rep?
Yeah, I work for Live Nation and Outback Presents. And it's a whole different world. It's, you know, it's all about budgets and all the business side of it. And especially right now, it's just so stressful because all the budgets are out of whack with the pandemic and stagehands are short on every call but it's a different side of it. You know, it's definitely a lot of responsibility, but I love it. You know, it's a good gig. I was afraid Sterling was trying to get my job once and he was like, I would never want your job.
I never want it.
I told him straight up, I don't want your fucking job, man. Yes, I couldn't do it. dealing with all those people. I like the whole roadie thing of, you know, your job and you do it. If you see somebody needs help, you give them help. But if you know your job and that's what you do. And he's got like 50 million jobs, wears 50 million hats, puts up with all the assholes, all the upper management assholes. And I couldn't do it. There's no way.
And you.
And me. And me to boot, this asshole.
Yeah, amazing. The number one.
I'm working with him on Saturday.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you guys together. Doing?
We're doing a podcast for Live Nation Comedy called How Was This Made? And it has three sitcoms stars on it. And so it should be interesting. It's for Live Nation Comedy. And then I got Mudvayne the next week with Rob Zombie. So that'll be another good show. It's Mudvayne, mm-hmm. Rob Zombie, Static X, and Power Man 5000, which I love Power Man 5000.
Absolutely.
They're underrated. That's Rob's little brother, Spider.
Yeah, yeah. Kick-ass band.
Yep.
Do you get a lot of people hitting you up that want you to produce and engineer their albums, Sterling?
Honestly, nowadays, I do get some people, but not as many as you'd think because, man, Pro Tools closed a lot of fucking studios, man. The invention of the DAW, the digital audio workstation, has really put the crimpers on the brick and mortar studios. And I still think in America that at least in America that they are still recovering from that. And most of the stuff I get is what I call salvage work, because people come to me and go, I thought I could do this, but evidently I'm not a producer. And can you fix this? So I get a lot of that. I get a lot of fix this. And then if it's just too bad, I go, listen, let's go back, start at square one. But not as many as you'd think, man. I think the whole market's music being put out has exploded, and there's more music now than there ever has been in the history of recorded music. But I at least around here, there's not a whole lot of it coming my way, that's for sure. So that's why I supplement with live shows. I work at a couple of different venues here in town, and then the teaching thing. So
you can go back on the road pretty easily. I think everybody's trying to crew up right now.
No, I don't want to go on the road. My traveling days are over. I had to quit drinking to figure out that I hated traveling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't as much fun when you knew where you were at.
When I got sober, it was like, why the fuck did I do this? But I wouldn't trade any of it for anything. It was the best time of my life. But but at one point, it just got to be too much. Just all the planes, trains, automobiles, hotels. And I just couldn't do it anymore. And I was just like, nah, I'm done. Done with that part of my life.
You feel you got the most out of it, then there's room to move on, you know?
Totally.
Other things.
Totally.
And one of my favorite ones is, do you guys have any gigs in mind that are like some of the worst shitholes ever known to man? Places that stand out that you're like, you wouldn't believe this gig we had to do.
I just did one. It's fresh in my mind. I was out with Playboi Carti doing his tour and for Outback. It's Motor Rep. And we were playing in Rochester, New York. And it was the Armory there. And there was no, this is the middle of winter. The buses we had to leave on so they didn't freeze over. There was no hot water. The breakfast was like, served them in these little tins, you know. And it was, you know, we were short on rigors, short on hands. It was freezing outside. It was just one of those gigs. It wasn't a bad room, but the backstage, they just, I think they had furniture from Goodwill. I'm not sure. It was just one of those, you know, you go from playing the Barclay Center. Sorry about that. You go from playing the Barclay Center in New York to this venue, and you're just like, what just happened here?
Yeah. A little bit of understanding how life goes up and down.
Oh, you know, every city has its little niches, you know, and You know, and the local people there were trying their hardest, you know, bless their hearts. But, you know, I don't try to take anything away from them because they were doing the best they could with what they had.
Yeah.
But, man, it was and then if you've ever been to the Lone Star Amphitheater in Lubbock, I do a few shows out there a year, and it's an old cattle slaughter yard.
Dust Bowl.
Yeah, it's a Dust Bowl, and you go into offices, there's furniture, and if it rains, there's leaks, and, you know, it's an adventure for sure.
I've been there's a couple I did, and I can't remember where this one was, and it was on Damage Plan, and this place was literally we couldn't tell. We were touring with Drowning Pool. They were out with us. And me and Mikey, the drummer, couldn't tell if this place was being built or if it was being torn down. That's how bad it was. It didn't have a roof. I've got pictures of it. There, over the stage, there was a blue and a white tarp, bungee corded down over the stage. It was quite the adventure. And it was somewhere in the Midwest. I can't remember where. And then there, you know, there's just been gigs in other countries that are just hellacious, you know, where you go to the bathroom and there's no toilet. There's just a hole in the ground and you squat over the hole, you know how it is, you know, the drill. So yeah, places
you
like
Damage that. Plan. Was Snake Sable out with you guys?
No.
Oh, okay.
What?
The Snake was managing them, no?
Drowning Pool?
No, Damage Plan.
No.
Mixed up?
No, at that point, it was Paul Bassman, Bass Management. He was also still managing Drowning Pool at that time, too. So
it makes sense why they're together. Here, hold on, let me look it up, who he was. What's Phil's band called? I know
that Snake was doing that band that Rex went off into for a while.
The Down?
No,
it was down,
and then he did Arms of the Sun and a couple other things, but yeah, Snake was doing that stuff.
Okay, so, yeah, I'll cut it out. Yeah, I don't know. I had Snake on here, and he was fucking great.
Snake's awesome. I love that dude.
Awesome, dude. I made a movie years ago, and Snake flew out or didn't fly out. He was in LA at the time, and he did a bunch of the music for me for free. He sat up all night and just played for me.
Wow.
Awesome guy, brilliant guy.
Didn't Skid Row just put out a new album?
I think they're touring.
Yeah, yeah.
They just got this new singer from Finland or somewhere over in that area. Sounds just like Sebastian Bach in his heyday.
Whoa. Okay.
Wow.
Nice. I'll have to check it out.
Killer.
Cool.
What are some of the funnier opening acts that you had for Pantera or any of those tours?
Funny, I don't know.
Unexpected, maybe. Unexpected might be better.
There were a couple of different times where, you know, you're overseas and you don't quite get to pick the opener, you know, kind of thing. The local promoter throws whoever on the bill, some local band, and I can't remember. We were in, or even here too, we were in like playing some arena in Cleveland or something, and this opening band, I of course don't remember the name of them. They were horrible, and they would just finish a song and it would be crickets. And they finished one song, and me and Grady were both on stage, and Grady was tuning up Dime's guitars, and we were just standing over there drinking a beer or whatever, just standing around, and they finished their song, and this is like 4,000-5,000 people, deathly quiet. And then you out of the, from the upper tier of the nosebleeds, you hear, "You suck," and it was just one voice, just one dude. So me and Grady got a laugh out of that, and we still to this day do that. We go, "You suck." Yeah. So one of those little inside jokes. And man, we were in Australia, and Silverchair opened for us, and this is when they were like little kids still. And Daniel Johns didn't know how to have his guitar plugged in, like where you loop it through the strap and you can't step on it and pull it out. Well, he stepped on the cord and pulled it out. And me and Grady are standing there watching on the side of the stage, and it's like we're looking at his tech and we're like, are you going to run out there? Are we going to run out there? What's going on here, dude? And he finally caught it and ran out there. But me and Grady were just about to take off and go, help here, dude. But yeah, I mean, just funny, weird moments like that. But I don't know, man. There's, I mean, it's one of those questions where you ask it and this, you want this flood of stuff to come back memory wise, but it's like, there's so many, it's like a traffic jam in my head.
Yeah.
I do remember this story that Kat and Grady used to tell me, that, they had this band warming up for them this was on Cowboys from Hell tour. And it was a metal band called Grunt Truck. Remember them? A Grunt Truck. And so they had a sheet scrim over Vinny's kit. So it was all black over Vinny's kit and you couldn't see back there. And Grunt Truck was on the stage and Grady and Kat are behind the scrim and in between song, they're sitting over there getting drunk behind the scrim and in between songs, Kat would grab a drumstick and go on Vinny's hi-hat and do the count off and the rest of the band would jump in and the drummer for Grunt Truck would be like, I didn't do that. You know, they would make a false start and they did that like to him like 5 or 6 times one night. So, yeah.
Do you remember any other good windups that you guys played on each other?
Oh, yeah, all the time, man. It was always something, man. Dime always had fireworks backstage. I don't know how many times we had the fire marshal back in the dressing room going, guys, you can't be doing this. And then, you know, hey, come on, man, do a shot with us. And sure enough, they'd get the fire marshal drunk and, you know, just funny shit. And then, God, we dropped all kinds of shit from the lighting grid on the opening bands, like rubber balls, ping pong balls. Send somebody out on stage dressed up, or one day we just came. I think one time we were on tour in Japan and White Zombie, we had done something to them before our set, and I can't remember what it was, but then for our set, they came out, Rob Zombie and the whole band came out and just set a table in the middle of the stage and started eating dinner right in the middle of our set. So, and then we got into a big food fight on the stage and the Japanese people really freaked out and said, oh my God, you've dishonored our stage and all of this stuff. It was a big deal. And they had to pay like several thousand dollars worth of damage, but it was fun.
What was the dishonor? They were eating like,
I don't know.
It's important information.
I know. I wondered what it was too, you know,
chronicling this.
what did we dishonor here? What manners? I don't know. I don't get it. So
they didn't get invited to sit down.
I guess they just were dishonored.
Some mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
You know, not to go down a negative road. And if it's something we want to skip over, it's totally cool. You probably know what I'm going to ask. But were you working that show when everything went down?
No, I had quit about 6 months before that. I had gotten into a fight with the tour manager and I did not want to do another one of my failed attempts at quitting being on the road and quitting drinking. And I went home and was pissed for a while, but got over it real quick because you couldn't stay pissed at Dime and Vinny very long. And so, you know, I went home and I had got to actually see them when they came through here and played the Ridgely right before all of that happened. But
oh, it's great. You got the opportunity to.
Yeah, no, we remained friends. And in fact, after I came home, they had called me not too long after that and said, hey, we need you down in the studio. We want you to help record some acoustic songs for the band Soil. And so that's when I got to work with Soil in the studio. I'd been, you know, we'd been on the road together with them before, but I got to work with them in the studio and that was really fun. And it was just acoustic versions of songs that they had already done for radio release. And so I recorded them with the band and then Vinny mixed them and they're out there somewhere, the acoustic versions of some of their songs. So that was cool, you know, and you know, no, I wasn't there that night, but then you go through the whole thing, you know, survivor guilt and I could have been there. Maybe I could have done something and just yep. the, the dumb shit you put yourself through as a human being. But now that I've had almost 20 years to process it, you know, it's, I'm glad I wasn't there. That would have been horrific. You know, poor cat got shot 3 times and mayhem. And, you know, the tour manager at that point, Chris Peluska, almost died. So, you know, not a good scene, not a good scene at all.
How did you find out about it initially?
Sean from Soil called me. I was sitting at home that night. I hadn't recently kicked my girlfriend out. I was very happy about that. I was just sitting at home with nothing to do, and the phone rang, and it was him. I'd looked at the phone, and I was like, I'll talk to him later. And then I checked my message, and he said, man, we're about to go on stage. Please check on this for me. We're hearing something weird about Dime. Get back with me as soon as you can after the show. And sure enough, then right after that is when my phone rang, and it was at the time Pat Lockman's girlfriend, Allison, who unfortunately is also no longer with us. She called and said, you better get over to Dime's house right now. And sure enough, I went over there, and the cops were there, and Rita was there, and just basically camped out there for the next few days. Things were going on, you know.
Well, that's a terrible moment.
It is. It really is.
Yeah. All right. So when I first started putting this podcast together, I was at my friend's house. My buddies have little kids now. And my friend's daughter said to me, it's a sad, you know, talking about that stuff. It's just, it sucks, man, you know?
Yeah. Still gets me.
It's really bad. I was with my friends though, it was his daughter, and she was in fifth grade at the time. And so she was with her little girlfriends, and she said to me, you know, you should ask every guest when they first felt famous. It's proved to be a really great question. And so I ask each of you guys, when did you first feel famous? Now, if fame is not something that you think you are, that's okay. When was there a moment in each of your careers that you would say was a pivotal moment, a meaningful moment, something important to you that you guys would each like to share?
Go.
And go.
You know, I just working for some of these different bands I listened to in high school. I remember on Slayer's farewell tour not too long ago, just standing on the side of the stage listening to South of Heaven. And, you know, and the first time I worked with Priest, you know, going, God, you know, eighth grade Jeff, who used to ride on his boaters, you know, all these metal bands would just not believe that you're actually here. And not only you're here on the side of the stage, but you're writing the checks to these guys, you know, and you're in charge of the show. And
you're like, not a good enough show tonight, Priest.
You know, I
always knock your pay.
You know, if the show is successful and it goes great, my boss gets the credit. And if anything goes bad, I get the credit.
You know? Well, yeah, right.
But you know, I mean, I've done so many shows where, you know, I just sit there and I'm standing on the side of the stage, and you know, and I'm just going, God, man, I'm fucking blessed. You know, yeah. I made it. You know, but I got sober actually at Dime's Memorial was my last drink.
Oh.
And it's funny because all that time before that and touring and everything else, I never had those moments because I was always fucked up on coke or drinking, and I never had a chance to take it in and go, wow, you know, I made it or whatever. And now I sit there and go, why did I ever get in this career?
What was the drink you had at the funeral?
I remember being, I don't want to say who I was with, but I was with a couple people in the industry, and we were at the Sheraton next door, and we were doing these Black Tooth shots, and I had a bag of coke and a bag of ice on me, and I got so drunk that I could not find my drugs. And the singer for Evermore was there, and apparently I threw something at Eddie Van Halen's head. I don't remember that. But then I was out smoking with Eddie, you know, and it was just one of those, it was one of those weird nights. And the singer Forevermore called me the next day and said, you know, do you want to go to an AA meeting? And I haven't looked back since.
Dude, that's great. Are you still tight with him?
Yeah. In fact, he texted me yesterday, something silly, you know? So yeah, I'm still very tight with those guys. And, you know, the guitar player, he ended up going back to Deep Blue something, and they called me the other day to go out and guitar check and TM for him. And unfortunately I'm not available, but, I've kept that relationship, you know, and one side of me regrets it, because I'm like, God, it'd be nice to do a neck down job, you know, go out and do support for, you know, some silly arena tour, you know, it'd be a great feeling.
Yeah, bit of fun, something different. Did you guys see them put the Eddie's guitar in the casket and stuff when you were there?
Yeah.
I was backstage and wasted. I didn't see any of that.
Well, I was there the evening at the funeral home when Eddie and Matt Brook brought it in. And when he said what he said to Rita, you know, Dime was an original. He deserves an original. And they opened the case, and there was that guitar, the Bumblebee guitar, and everybody standing there just immediately knew what it was, you know, and we all just, you know,
oh yeah,
busted out crying. And yeah.
And you watched him put it in there? Mm. Wow, that's crazy.
It was a very heavy. It's one of, I've had several of these throughout my lifetime, but you know, it's one of those things where you stand there and you're like, you are literally a part of history. You are witnessing history, you know, just, it yeah. was pretty heavy. And then just all the emotional energy there. Yeah, it was intense, very intense.
So Eddie's the one who put it in the casket?
He handed it to Rita, and I believe Rita did it.
See, I don't know, my fear would be like, touching that dead body with it, you know, because your hands might just, I don't know. I don't know. I'd be like,
they won't bite.
No, I probably ain't gonna do, yeah, probably not, but
they don't bite, man.
Yeah. Still, what a moment.
Yeah, quite a moment.
Yeah. What's your speaking of moments? So what would be your moment when you felt famous, or a definitive moment in your career?
I don't know about famous, and I got two little stories here. And first of all, that's funny and ironic that a kid is asking you that, because kids usually don't give a shit about that. My kid could care less who I've worked with, what I've done. It does not impress him. He is like, I just want to know, you know, if you're coming to my basketball game. You know, it's that.
Cool.
Which is good.
It's good. Good. Yeah.
It's a very good thing. And so that they don't care about so much. And I've taken him to so many shows. It's silly, but that I find that very funny. But the first time that I really felt like, wow, was the first band I ever saw in 1982 was Cheap Trick. That was my first concert I ever got to go to.
Great. Yeah.
It was the One-on-One tour, and I absolutely loved him. Well, years go by, I get in the business, blah, blah, blah. I'm on tour with Pantera 1994. It's probably April or May or June, sometime 94. And we're in Japan. And the way they do it in Japan, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but yeah, you'll do like 10 shows in Tokyo, you know?
Yeah, usually a dinner there on the stage.
Exactly. And so we're doing several shows in Tokyo, and Aerosmith is doing several shows in Tokyo, and Cheap Trick's doing a bunch of shows in Tokyo. So Mr. Udo, the promoter guy, gets us tickets. We all, band, crew, everybody, we all go to see Cheap Trick at one of the venues that we're playing, like we'd already played or we were playing the next night, whatever. We're all staying at the same area of town down in the Roppongi district. And they were just so fucking cool. And Rick is showing his guitars off to Dime, and Tom grabs me and Rex and shows us this bass rig that he bought from Jimmy Page and all of this cool shit. And then we go and drink at this little bar that we were frequenting for that week that we were there in Japan, called Pips. And it was this little bitty basement bar. And so us and Cheap Trick go down to this little bitty basement bar in Tokyo, Japan, and we're just partying, having a blast. And me and Dime are just standing at the bottom of the stairs. And here comes Rick Nielsen in this really, really loud red suit, something you would totally see Rick Nielsen wearing. And he comes right down to the bottom of the stairs, and it's just me and Dime standing there. And he goes, "Well, boys, are we ready to party?" And he fans out this huge fan of money and just goes, "Ha ha 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 ha," just does this weird laugh. And I'm like, and I'm standing there, and I go, "I have arrived."
Yeah, you know, this is going to be crazy.
In my head, I'm just going, "I have arrived, man." And just, yeah, it blew my mind. And to this day, that's one of my favorite nights. I will always remember that.
And where did you guys go?
We were just there in that bar, and we partied until the sun came up.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
In that little Pips bar, us and Cheap Trick, the whole band was there. So yeah, all the band and crew for us, band and crew for Cheap Trick, and we wrecked that joint. Bought them out of all their booze. So it was fun, man. It was really fun. And then I think another moment that was really pivotal for me, like Jeff, I have a similar, you know, Pantera kind of getting sober story. I took my last drink in Vinnie Paul's kitchen, and there was a point, and that was right in the middle of trying to do the second Hell Yeah album, Stampede, the one we were talking about with Marcus. And, you know, I always thought getting sober would be really hard for me because of the group of people can't call them anything less than family. I'm sorry. Everybody thinks that's a cliche, but it's true. And I always thought I would get a hard time, you know, "Oh, you big pussy, blah, blah, blah." And it was when I told Vinny, when I finally worked up the courage to tell Vinny I'm getting sober, he was like, "Man, I've been waiting a long time to hear you say that, and I'm glad for you. And we're gonna make sure that you're protected and your best interests are in our best interest. So I'm glad to hear you say that." And that just blew my mind. And that was upstairs in the studio at his house. It was just me and him and during the making of that album. And so from that moment on, he was like my biggest champion of all of that, you know. "Hey, don't bother him with drinks," or "Hey man, you want me to fix you a virgin margarita," or whatever, you know, just always like super cool about it, you know.
You know, so it's funny you say that, Sterling, because I was it was right after Dime's death, and me and Darren DeLatte, which, you know, we went over to Vinny's for the Super Bowl, and we're sitting in this living room. There's only about 10 people over there, and Vinny's cooking up a storm. And everybody does shots to Dom. And I remember it came to me, and I'm sitting on my hands just, you know, still shaking because I was only a few months sober. And Vinny goes, "Do you not drink or are you retired?" And I said, "I'm retired." And he made me a shot of Dr. Pepper. And it was like the sweetest thing that anybody could have ever done, because I felt, you know, like, here,
you're the odd man out,
you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I want to fit in, you know. And it was one of those things I very easily could have just went the other way just to try to fit in with them.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. But they were good like that. You know, there was always those moments of the old Pantera mantra of drink it or wear it. But it was if you were serious about it, then they were too, you know. There was a line that they didn't cross, and that was I didn't find out till later that was one of them, you know. But another really cool moment of, wow, these dudes, he really does have my back, he really is my bro, you know. And yeah. it continued on after that, you know.
Yeah, that's nice to hear the other side of stuff, you know, full person.
Yeah, man. real
ones. BB King. It's a selfish question. It's just so cool to me that you worked for BB King for anything. But how did it happen? What did you do?
I was just a staff engineer at Dallas Sound Lab, and he came in to do. He had been, whatever you want to call it. I don't know how anybody would hire BB King as a hired gun, but he was a featured player on a commercial for Greyhound buses. And he was like singing this song for Greyhound and playing a little guitar solo for Greyhound America. And I was the assistant engineer on the session, and he was so cool. He was so nice and hospitable. And he was like, he looked at me and he goes, "Young man, do you know how to tune a guitar?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he goes, "Will you tune up Lucille for me?" And he let me fucking tune Lucille, dude. And I was blown away by that.
Yeah, that's pretty neat stuff.
I'm getting chills just talking about
it. Yeah, did your hands tremble?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was shaking like a leaf, man. And I was like, I hope I don't drop this guitar. And it is a hunk of wood, dude. One of those Lucille guitars weighs about 15 pounds, man. It is a hunk of wood.
That's when you arrived.
Yeah. I didn't even think about it before then. Hey, Milton Berle asked me where the bathroom was once.
Did you say wherever you want it to be, sir?
Anywhere you want, Mr. Berle.
You're the only guy ever to ask.
such a weird, surreal place to work, you know, and such a weird way to make a living, you know. But, yeah. God, Jeff tells me all kinds of weird stories. Like one day he came in and said, "Man, I was smoking cigars last night with Gavin Rossdale and Gwen Stefani."
Yeah, that was cool. Right.
I'm like, huh?
Yeah, he's done a festival and they invited me for cigars. You know, and that's the cool thing. And I there's a thousand stories like that that I forget, you know. The people we meet and the people we get to hang out with and all that, you know, it's pretty cool. But at the end, they're all just people, you know?
Yeah. Unless they're not and they're complete assholes. And
I've dealt with some of those too, you know.
There's some of them that I just can't believe they're human, but whatever.
And it sucks because I can't listen to them on the radio anymore or listen to their music anymore.
Exactly.
And, I fucking hate Weezer. Those fucking dudes can suck my dick. I cannot listen to a Weezer song. But I remember, like, I wasn't I hate to admit this, but I wasn't like a real big Led Zeppelin fan. And I met Robert.
Never heard of him.
And he was so cool. And he was telling me this story about how Hot Dog came about, the origin. It was based out in Las Colinas, Texas, at the Four Seasons. And he was like, he's like, "Jeffrey, have you ever heard of a little band called Led Zeppelin?" And I'm like, "No, sir." You know, he was the nicest guy. Now every time I hear Zeppelin, I just crank it up because he was so fucking nice. You know, so, you know, it is one of those things that now I do get to be around quite a few large bands, and I purposely try to stay away from them. You know, they say don't meet your heroes. You know, if you like the music, stay the fuck away from them, you know.
Yeah, my first tour was Stone Temple Pilots, and I knew who they were, but I wasn't a huge fan. But it was a difference. It's when I saw them perform, I was like, "I'm lucky to be here." And within a couple days, I was like, I knew it. I knew it. I was so lucky to be standing on the stage with these guys, because I started seeing all these bands playing. I'm like, you're better. Like, you guys are. And it wasn't because I was working for them. It's because I witnessed it. And that's a cool feeling.
It's if they're tight and they're good, that creates energy, man. And once you witness that, everything else is shit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. You know, you've got like Metallica standing on the side of the stage because they want to watch the band you work for, and you're looking back like, I get to see them every night. You know, it's cool, and they give me a couple bucks. So it's not a bad gig. It's not.
Nope.
Well, gentlemen, I do appreciate your time. If you have any other stories that you wanted to say before we're done, you're welcome to say them now. But if not, I look forward to talking to you guys soon.
One time I saw Jeffrey drink 17 pints of mango juice.
Oh, I'm bad too.
I forgot about that. The worst part was I go out to the parking lot and I go, I think I'm going to throw up. And he's like, well, you drank 17 cups of mango juice. He goes, why did you? And I was like, why didn't you tell me to stop? And he goes, I wanted to see what would happen.
Were you in the bathroom for 2 days straight?
No, I wasn't, luckily, but Jesus Christ.
It didn't fuck you up?
No, no.
Wow, you are. You're not from here. You're an alien.
Iron Man.
I've done a lot of drugs and alcohol through my life. It takes a lot to keep me, to knock me down.
The mango juice spread throughout you. It's fixing.
I do have a funny road story that I remember when you were talking about something. Is I was out with Lillian Axe and we went on tour with Accept, which is like two totally different bands. Lillian Axe was like,
I know this story.
And I remember the sound guy, we just got finished playing and the sound guy goes, oh good, now that Lillian Axe is off stage, all the real men are here. And he takes off his shirt to mix. And I just remember going, what the fuck is going on here? But good times.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, thank you very much, guys. We'll do it again. And I'll talk to you guys soon. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Peace.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rody. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.